everyone. Welcome to another edition of Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Show Ali, Julia Kreutz with you for the next couple of hours. Hope you're all doing well this morning. You know, Jules, the day after the MLB All-Star Game is often referred to as like the quietest day on the sports calendar because nothing is going on. And it's funny, I often mark this day because of what happened in 2018. I was filling in, much like we are today, for Blake. Blake's going to be back on Monday, but I was filling in on the in the newsroom with the assignment desk, with the editing team. And on July 18th, it's the 17th today, but still, in terms of the day after the All-Star Game, July 18th, 2018, I was sitting there and it was like, oh, there's nothing happening today. This is great. Like, just watched an okay All-Star Game, whatever, back in 2018. It's going to be a pretty easy day. There was no one on. Blair was still doing the Jeff Blair show from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. And he was off on vacation as well. So like everyone was not a very regular day because right. No one was here. And then boom, in the morning, 8:30 a.m. Eastern, Kawhi Leonard has been traded to the Toronto Raptors. And I remember, and then all hell broke loose in the newsroom, yes. Right? And I thought, man, this is like my first quietest day in sports history after the All-Star Game, and it was anything but. So who knows what happens today is my point.
Yeah, I thought you were going to refer it as somewhat of a hangover day because that's kind of what it feels what it like. Yeah, there true. Was just so much, so many bright lights and noise and bombs being hit yesterday that it does feel a little bit like we all need a day to recover, right? Not just the players, not just the entire sports media world. Kind of needs a day off. So, yeah, let's hope for a quiet one. Maybe the sports gods will smile upon us here, show.
Even if it does end up being the quietest day in sports history, if nothing crazy happens, our producer Amit Mann has done a great job putting together our guest lineup today. So Brandon Weil from The Score will help us wrap things up. Dan Shulman will stop by at the top of the next hour. And Nick Mingione, head coach for Kentucky baseball, will join us as well. Kentucky baseball producing a lot of Canadian baseball talent, including Emilien Pitre, who was taken by the Rays on day one of the MLB draft. So a lot to come today. But like you said, the All-Star Game officially in the books. The American League winning 5-3. They have lost the All-Star Game just four times since 1997. So the American League is now 22-4 with oddly one tie in there. But what did you think of last night's game?
How is it possible, first of all, that is the record? It seems very improbable right. that the American League would...
The rosters turn over all the time? I mean...
Yes.
And, how is that possible?
And, you know, they basically, the NL got the best player in the world this time around with Shohei Ohtani, who certainly made an impact. Sure. And still, and yet, but when you look at the lineups, they look pretty evenly matched, right? Even in the bullpen or things along those lines. And it just, I don't know, it keeps happening for some reason. So first of all, my first impression is that is very weird. And then when you're past that, you're like, okay, this is just baseball being baseball. It doesn't really make a lot of sense a ton of time. What would make sense, though, is that a guy like Jaren Duran would shine, right? This has been such an incredible season for a kid that, you know, had obviously been in an upward trajectory, but it wasn't maybe even 2 years ago that we saw him kind of struggle with the Red Sox and you know, trying to find his footing in the major leagues. His defense was a huge question mark for the Red Sox, and then all of a sudden now he's putting up career numbers. He's in the All-Star game, and it's just... It's really indicative, show, of, you know, how bright this career can be, which is not necessarily great news for the Blue Jays, who have to face Jaren Duran a lot as a member of the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, the Red Sox are a very young team, right? I mean, they had Willier Abreu, Seidan Rafaela, Jaren Duran. If you remember, maybe you remember better than I do, but you and I were doing Jays Talk a couple of years ago when the Jays were at Fenway. I believe it was right after the All-Star break. They had a series. Like maybe like literally the first three games after the All-Star break.
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
Yeah, this year it's in Detroit, or it's in Toronto against Detroit, and that year was at Boston. And that was when they set the franchise record for runs. Was Jaren Duran not the center fielder on the Tapia inside the park home run?
Yes.
Or Grand Slam, I should say.
You will remember Jaren Duran, the meme of Jaren Duran just raising his arms up in the air as if to say, I have no idea where this ball
yeah,
is.
That was so good.
It landed quite a few feet behind him, if I'm not mistaken. He really had no idea where that ball was, and it did make for a pretty iconic moment in recent years for the Blue Jays. To see that guy become the All-Star MVP, and he's been pretty good defensively in the outfield for the Red Sox this year. So, you know, it's just a testament of development doesn't truly end when you get to the major leagues, and this is a guy that is proving as much.
You know, I think on the whole, when it comes to the All-Star game, again, you know, I've been doing a lot of comparing to other sports, and I think it is the only All-Star game. Like, it's the best All-Star game, and the reason for that is because it's the only one where it feels like the players actually try. You know what I mean? Like, I think the NHL All-Star game, I think, comes close because in recent years they've had that like thing where they draft teams, and then like they have like four teams in the NHL All-Star game, and they kind of have like a mini tournament almost. And then when you get to the finals, I mean, I know that the effort level isn't 100% as you see in the MLB All-Star game, which is why I think it's number two. But I mean, like, The Pro Bowl was so bad they stopped doing it essentially in the NFL, which I mean, like, that was truly horrendous. I said, as a huge NFL fan, that was truly horrendous. But then you have the NBA All-Star game where the scores are like 200 to 199 or something by the end of the game. So I don't know. I'm out on the NBA All-Star game for that reason as well. But while the MLB All-Star game is the ones where the players actually try, I do kind of can't help but think if maybe it should have, like, maybe some more stakes. You know, like, you know, back in 2016 or 2017 is when they stopped the whole, you know, the winning league gets home field advantage in the World Series thing. Like, they stopped that. And I don't know if that's the exact answer, but like, there should be, I think, something tangible to winning, because it feels like they actually try.
Yeah, it does. I think that I wouldn't necessarily advocate for the return of that rule because it seems a little bit extreme.
Are they supposed to care that much if you're on a bad team and you're on an all-star team? Like, probably not, right?
Yeah, it's not really. I don't think it should be decided like that, because primarily, you know, one of the beauties of the all-star game is the fact that it doesn't really impact what's happening in the season and beyond. And so there should be something more. I agree with you, but it should be a little less. Important. Let's put it that way. We should still keep sort of the fun nature of the game. I also believe, Sho, that one thing that contributes to the level of trying, of effort that we actually see in the diamond for those games is the fact that, you know, most guys are going to play a couple of innings.
That's true too.
And then they're out, right? So they know that they have a limited amount of time to show out, to show up and do something special. So then you're going to get the Trey Turner plays on that Vladdy batted ball early on in the game, or you're going to get the Shohei home runs, Vladdy himself making a good play at first base later on in the game before he exited. So that little pocket of time, first of all, it gives us a chance to look at some more guys. And second of all, it kind of allows players to zoom in and understand, okay, this is the amount of innings that I have in order to make an impact here and make a highlight reel for myself. So I'm just going to go all out.
It was pretty funny. And I don't know how intentional this was, but not every player played in the American League team. I believe Torey Lovullo did get, I think he got everyone in there. I think everyone did play, even if it was for like two outs, right? I think even like, who was it? Christopher Sanchez, who came in, I think he threw like two or three pitches and then exited the game in a mid-inning pitching change, which was actually kind of funny, I thought. But I think they made a point to get as many, if not all, of the NL players in there as possible. Less so, does not look like Bruce Bochy was that concerned. I actually thought it was kind of funny because, of course, Bruce Bochy is the manager of the Rangers. And it didn't really feel like a lot of the other players from that division specifically ended up playing. Like, I don't think Andrés Muñoz got into the game. Yeah, I think he was the only Mariners representative, if I'm correct there. No one from the Angels got into the game, so Tyler Anderson did not pitch. And Yordan Alvarez, maybe a little different for Alvarez, right? I think he only took one AB and then that was it, right? So it's just funny. It just seemed like every other team in the Rangers division basically did not have a lot of guys to play. I'm certain it was not intentional, but it did. Maybe it's just because Bruce Bochy he's kind of just grumpy looking. It just kind of looked like he did it on purpose, but it was kind of funny to see that, you know, not everyone played. I do wonder if that should be a rule going forward. Like, if you're an all-star, maybe you play, even if it's for like a one AB like Alvarez, or if it's for a single out or something. Maybe there is something there. And again, maybe it's also, maybe Munoz didn't really care, or maybe Tyler Anderson didn't really care and they acquiesced to that. But maybe, I don't know, maybe that should be part of it.
Yeah, I believe a couple of years ago we had a similar situation with Jordan Romano, went into the All-Star game. He was in the bullpen for the game, but he didn't get to come in. And then the following year, obviously, we saw him actually pitch in an all-star game. So it does happen from time to time. I mean, it can, I believe, get a little frustrating for fan bases that don't get to see, you know, if you have one all-star representative and that guy does not come into the game, even though he's there, I can see how that would be a little bit frustrating. But also there's a lot of people, it's a lot of moving parts. And to your point, Bruce Bochy doesn't have a care in the world right now, right?
He doesn't care now.
That was his fifth All-Star game as a manager, which is pretty impressive. He was very, very candid speaking about it in that, you know, he said, I hadn't really given it any thought, but now that I'm here, oh boy, I guess, yeah, it is really impressive. Kind of pat himself on the back, which is, you know, classic Bruce Bochy.
Sure. Yeah.
A guy that, you know, he's probably got a Hall of Fame resume at this point, and I mean, he was just living in front of the home crowd. It was pretty cool to see him.
He's probably a guy who honestly had a Hall of Fame resume with the Giants alone.
Yes.
And then he retired, and then they dragged him out of retirement, and then yes, he won another World Series, right?
How do you explain it?
Yeah,
you got to be that good.
That's so good. I got a couple more for you. Did Paul Skeens live up to the hype? And I only ask this because we made a lot. I mean, I don't want to speak for it when I say we. I certainly made a lot of to-do about Skeens being made the NL starter, because I think there is like a little bit of cachet for whoever is the starter, even if it doesn't like 100% mean a whole lot, because like you said earlier, these guys are not exactly pitching, like they're not pitching six innings in the All-Star game. They're throwing like, they're getting like three outs and that's effectively it. And, or they have like a pitch count limit if things get particularly out of hand, for example. But, you know, I think people were in Detroit were probably a little annoyed that Corbin Burnes got the start over Tarek Skubal,
right,
which I can understand. I think Skubal probably deserved it. Corbin Burnes has had a pretty good season. Has he had as good a season as Skubal? I don't know, probably say no, but I don't think it really matters. But I do think that the Paul Skeens thing was interesting because he's so young and he's a phenom and he was called up like 66 days before the All-Star game. And here he is starting. Like, how often do you see something like that? So I think there was an aspect of that conversation, Jules, where it was like, does he deserve it? I did think he deserved it, but it's just funny. When you talk about the hype, at least we did get to see Skeens v. Soto and Judge, but at the same time, it's not like he pitched that much deeper into the ball game, so we didn't see him against like Vladdy or any of these other guys.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I thought a lot about this when, you know, the selection kind of came and,
right,
and it was announced that he would be the starter. I can understand that this is a huge conversation around baseball right now, and this is a guy that is obviously extremely exciting, and he's going to be around, you know, for a long time. Knock on wood. Let's hope nothing happens. Pitching injuries have been a lot, but this is a guy that has the potential to have a very, very good career here. I understand the hype, and I understand why we would want to see him starting that All-Star game. But at the same time, you look at other pitchers. That actually showed up for the NL, a guy like Shota Imanaga, even Max Fried. These are guys that have been doing it for a little bit longer. Obviously, Imanaga coming from Japan and all of that, but they have a little bit more experience in pro ball. And, you know, maybe if you were to go the route of justice or whatever, for whatever that means, perhaps going with a little bit more of a veteran guy would sit better with some pockets of baseball fandom here. Did he live up to the hype? I don't know. I mean, it was pretty cool. I think that the Soto at bat was probably the highlight of his inning. And he struck Soto out, right? That last pitch that was called for a ball was 100 miles per hour in the zone.
Yeah.
So
it did feel like they were jobbing a little to make sure that he got to face Judge.
A little bit. I mean, Juan Soto was very vocal pregame about, I will make sure that Aaron Judge gets to face Paul Skeens, which he did.
I guess, yeah.
Yes, maybe, you know, loudly so, because he was gesturing for a base on balls immediately after that pitch and ended up getting it. And then Aaron Judge comes in and grounds out in one or two pitches, I think, right? So, yes, we got to see it, but then the universe kind of balanced it out and gave us only a couple of pitches against Skeen against Judge.
Well, you know what they say, Jules, ball don't lie, right? So that's what happened with Judge there. I guess, you know what I think people wanted to see? People wanted to see, And this is going to be, I think, the example we use for a long time, or maybe at least until the next WBC, but people wanted to see Mike Trout v. Shohei Ohtani.
Yep.
Like that, and I mean, that had its own moment because it was a pressure-packed situation, one of the best hitters in the world versus one of the best pitchers in the world, who were also teammates, right? I think that was a big part of it. I just saw a lot of that sentiment circling online and kind of in the lead-up, like, we want to see the best on best, which I think is like, obviously you get that at the All-Star game, but it's just... I don't know, when Judge is batting third in like the bottom of the first inning, it's not like quite the same. You know what I mean? I wonder how much it could have possibly lived up to the hype. Like, because what? I mean, if Judge had taken Skeens deep for a home run, then what you would have said? Oh, Skeens, like, he's not actually that good. Like, oh, you can't. Judge is the best hitter in baseball, but I mean, he's still got this guy. It's kind of like a bizarre conversation to have. But it doesn't mean I don't appreciate watching Paul Skeens pitch. He's clearly extremely talented. I actually think, like, and tell me where you fall on this, because in a general sense, when I look at the All-Star game, Skeens is a good example of this. You look at the American League, Mason Miller was throwing absolute gas. Emmanuel Clase comes in and gets the save in the All-Star game, and he's nasty. We've seen him do that to the Blue Jays and many other teams over the course of his career. I do enjoy it. I do enjoy watching the flamethrowers, right? At the same time, we spent a huge chunk of time over the last couple of days discussing why dingers are cool. Mm-hmm. Home runs are sick. You want to see offense, right? And I think... while I do love watching the gas and the flamethrowers, watching Mason Miller and Paul Skeens and Emmanuel Clase use triple digits to just annihilate the best batters in the world, I don't know, like, it's kind of underwhelming. I don't know. Is that kind of bizarre? Like, I both want it, but also when I got it, I thought, God, this is kind of boring after watching it like 10 straight times.
Yeah, just to go back to the Skeens thing for a little bit, I think that if he reached triple digits, he lived up to the expectations.
Okay, all right.
I think that's, you know, that's a pretty okay bar to set, especially for an All-Star game. I agree with you that after a while, you know, if you're like in a pitcher's duel at the All-Star game, that's not necessarily the most fun. We thankfully got to see some highlight reels on the defensive side as well. The home runs that we got were pretty cool.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And pretty iconic in their own way, with Ohtani, you know, for the first time as a Dodger going deep. And obviously Duran with the MVP effort there, the go ahead, and a pretty epic bat flip too. That was pretty nice to see. And a guy that kind of embodied the spirit of the All-Star game and just let it all loose. So it was I agree with you that maybe a little bit more balance would have been nicer, and just a way to keep the attention, right, at the All-Star game. Because after a while, if you see guys striking out over and over again or grounding out or whatever it is, you're probably going to look away for a couple seconds or go get a beer in the fridge or something like that. And
that's what you did.
But, well, no, absolutely not. I was on the clock. I was working.
Okay.
I would never do that. But, yeah, the minute after I was
on. The minute after, yes, that's fair.
It is a day of celebration after all, right?
Sure, yeah.
That's what it's there for.
It's the All-Star break, right? That's no shame here, certainly. I did enjoy it. It's just, I couldn't help but think in the moment when I was watching all of these guys, these incredibly talented pitchers, just come in here and do what they did essentially to the best hitters on earth. Like the best hitter, maybe in some of these cases, maybe some of the best hitters we've ever seen when it comes to Aaron Judge and Alvarez and some of these guys, right? And all I could think of was, gosh, if these guys have no chance against the best pitchers in the world, what is everyone else? What are the chances of like the mortal players in Major League Baseball have, right? I thought it was interesting because a big part of like we talked about at the beginning of why I personally like the All-Star game is because these guys are trying for real. Like they're actually trying. They're not like easing up. They're locating well. They're throwing strikes. And on the batter side, they're not like they're taking big hacks. Like they're not trying to ground out. They're like they're actually going forward. And because, like you said, in their relatively small sample size, they're not going to play a whole lot, right? But it's just funny because all I could think of was that it doesn't make for a lot of entertainment, because I think in today's day and age, pitchers just have an innate advantage over hitters, right? Like these guys' arms are doing things the human body probably wasn't meant to do.
Absolutely. You know,
the spin rate being at all-time highs and velo being at all-time highs, all these crazy things. And I love that kind of stuff. But it's just funny to think that the All-Star game, in theory, is supposed to be a showcase of a lot of these crazy aspects of baseball. And I feel like you actually, because you are seeing the best pitchers, you don't get to see the best hitters. which is kind of a weird paradox to live in, right? And we did get to see Shohei Ohtani jack a three-run bomb, which is pretty cool because, I mean, he probably is the best player on planet Earth, just period. And to see the best player do that in the biggest situation possible is exactly what you want. You just didn't really get it from anyone else, essentially.
Right on. I think it's a little bit of a testament to where we are in the game in that there is a ton of resources right now that are being put into maximizing the pitching side.
Right.
We're seeing these pitching labs come out and we're seeing guys, you know, Mason Miller set a new All-Star game record with I think it was 103.6 miles per hour.
That's just wild.
It's a lot, right? It's we are seeing that there is this new trend and this new era of pitchers coming in. And it's funny to think that, you know, everything around MLB and the discussion around MLB is kind of revolves around making sure that we get the most of the offense. So the rule changes, right? It's all designed to add some dynamic and to put the offense in a better position to succeed because that is what attracts eyeballs. But teams are countering with, okay, so we're going to develop our pitchers a different way,
right.
And we're going to bring these guys in and they're going to throw gas and things like that. And so it is a league of adjustment. It is a sport of adjustment. And that goes way beyond the day-to-day that we see in the field. And we were kind of, you know, experiencing a little bit of a new era right now, I believe.
I don't think anyone really means for the All-Star game to be some kind of like referendum on where baseball is,
yeah.
But I just think like you kind of just want to see some more fireworks
for
a little
sure.
bit, essentially is what you want, which I guess that's what the Derby is for in theory, but I mean, you also want to see, I know Aaron Judge already won the home run Derby a couple of years ago, but like you also want to see it happen like in a game setting where people are actually trying, right? Which is why I gotta give some credit to Jaron Duran because he came through in a big moment. I mean, the AL was down 3-0 and some timely hitting, including the Duran AB a couple of innings later, I think it helped contribute certainly to a big win. The Shohei home run, funnily enough, I didn't actually realize this until I saw the social media world kind of get aflame with this, but Ohtani, the first Dodger to hit a home run in the All-Star game since 1996. Mike Piazza was the last Dodger to hit a home run in the All-Star game. I guess it's just, I mean, there's a lot of luck to it, and like you said, the guys don't play a lot, so, you know, if you don't hit a home run in your, like, what, two ABs, probably max, of being at the plate, it's tough for you to do that, but it just kind of, I guess, again, kind of like when Teoscar won the Derby the other day, and it kind of seems surprising that, like, for a franchise as prolific as the Dodgers, they had never won the Derby prior to Teoscar Hernandez, and for Mike Piazza to be the last guy to hit a home run in a Dodgers uniform at the All-Star game is pretty incredible, honestly.
I was going to bring that up. It is amazing that, and it's in the same year, too, that we have, you know, the brand new, the very first Dodgers home run Derby winner, and then breaking that drought or stopping that drought of home runs in the All-Star game kind of makes you scared of what the Dodgers can do and how far this team can go. I believe that, especially for us here in Toronto, we're obviously always going to be watching what the Dodgers are doing because this is a very storied franchise and they have so many stars. Adding Ohtani to the mix has only attracted more eyeballs. We understand that, but at the same time, you look at this All-Star game and the prominence of Dodgers players and what they were able to do, and you kind of think, okay, they are reminding us of where they are and what they're vying for here. Obviously, the Dodgers will always be in the mix, I believe, to win championships and things like that, but it seems different this time, right? It seems like there's a little bit more impetus, I guess, or energy. So, yeah, put themselves even more on the map than we had already expected of them so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's World Series or bust in Chavez Ravine, right? So if they don't get it done, I don't know what the reaction from the Dodgers faithful will be. Before we go, we're going to talk to Nick Mingione, head coach of the Kentucky Wildcats on the other side, chat with him about some Canadian baseball players, get his take on the SEC and the college world where a lot of Canadian baseball players are playing. So we'll talk to him about that on the other side. But before we go, the uniforms have got to go, Jules. They've got to go. They're. I don't know where you fall on this. For me, they're hideous. I got to say, I don't know if this is a super strong take or what, but here's what
Ooh.
I want. I just want them to go back to be wearing their own team jerseys.
Right.
That's all I want. Like, just Vladdy, wear the Blue Jays blue, slap an All-Star patch on there, maybe some nice silver trim on the on like the arms or on the bottom of the jersey. And then, you know what? Everyone's happy. Just, I totally understand why there are new jerseys. It's to make money and it's to sell jerseys. Like, that's the point, right? That's just simply what it is. But I mean, come on, we want to see the guy like in the NFL and in the NHL and in basketball. A part of it is you kind of need to know who's on your team, right? So if everyone, like in the NBA, where everyone's running around at the same time and everyone's wearing different jerseys, I feel like it'd make it hard for you, like, mentally to actually know. In baseball, it's, like, not really a problem, right? They're all standing largely stationary.
Yes.
You're either standing at the plate or the pitcher standing on the mound or a guy standing between first and second or the short. You know what I mean? Like, you're generally standing. You know where everyone's standing when they're on the field. So it's not really a problem, which is why I think you can just go back to the normal jerseys, quote-unquote normal jerseys.
And we know from spring training that teams can actually wear extremely similar uniforms and still make it work. It happens from time to time. It is pretty jarring when that happens, but we know it is possible and they can play under those circumstances. I don't mind the uniforms.
That's a hot take.
I know. It's a super controversial opinion. And, you know, I feel like I have to apologize for even saying it. But I don't know. I kind of like, I'm not a fashion person. I don't have an eye for design or anything along those lines. But I kind of like them. Like, you know, if my life was different and I wasn't doing this, I may buy one of those jerseys.
Okay. So, wow. Okay.
You know, I don't tend to buy baseball jerseys, of course, but, you know, if things have fallen a different way, I liked it enough. I don't know. I know it's weird, but taste, right? What are you going to do?
I think in the now 3 days we've been doing this, that is your boldest take.
I think it is.
100%.
There's a reason why I didn't tweet about it. There's a reason. I think this is the first time I'm saying it out loud because you can see the very strong opinions that the internet had about those jerseys. So cat's out of the bag now. That's how I feel.
When we talk to Brandon Weil from The Score at the end of the show, we'll get his uniform take. I know he's very passionate about it. I don't know for sure. I think he leans with me and not with you, but we'll double check with him.
Okay. Should I leave the studio for that, or do you think we'll
If you want. We'll get the camera just on me. It's fine. That's totally fine. That's Julia Kreutz. I'm Show Ali. Nick Mingione, head coach of the Kentucky Wildcats, is going to join us on the other side of the break, chat about some Canadians coming through Lexington on the other side. That's still straight ahead. Dan Shulman at the top of the next hour as well. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network, watching on Sportsnet 360. We're back after this.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on this... Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Show Ali, Julia Kreutz with you on the radio, on TV, you're watching on Sportsnet 360. We appreciate you guys sticking alongside us. We're here until the top of the 12 p.m. Eastern hour, after which point we will make way for Going Deep with Donovan Bennett. At the top of the next hour, Dan Shulman will join us from Sportsnet, catch up with him during this All-Star break. And at the bottom of the next hour, we'll chat with Brandon Weil from The Score. But joining us right now, very pleased to be joined by Nick Mingione, head coach of the Kentucky Wildcats. Nick, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we appreciate you carving out some time for us. We really do. Before we discuss a number of your players that have made their way into the MLB system these past few days, I did want to ask you a more general question to start, Nick. You've been the coach down in Lexington since 2017 now. Congratulations on winning Coach of the Year. You've turned the team into a real contender in your time there. You're taking them all the way to the College World Series. I'm just curious, like, from a coach who has competed at the highest possible level, what goes into preparing these young men to compete at a really competitive level in the SEC?
How much time we have? how long is our segment going to be? Well, you know, there's a lot, and I often share this with our players in the recruiting process, is the development piece is something that we take very, very seriously. And as you know, the Southeastern Conference, the SEC, is the highest level of college baseball. I mean, it doesn't get any better. And with that development, we basically make a commitment to the parents that we're going to develop them in three areas. We're going to develop them as a student, a person, and a player. And when you go through each one of those three segments, there's this long list of things that you have to make sure they get right and they get in place. So from the player standpoint, there's really five levels to it. We want to develop them mentally. We want to develop them physically. We want to develop them behaviorally. We want to develop them technically and tactically. So you got to hit on all those. And then there's different levels to each of those. So it's definitely a complex process, but one we take very serious.
Hey, Nick, thank you for doing this. You mentioned the three areas here, student, person, player. When speaking specifically about Emilian Petrie, what do you see? What have you seen from him in terms of that development? What have the Tampa Bay Rays gotten out of Emilian Petrie here?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, first off, just thinking about him as a student, he was an academic All-American, and this was a guy who literally came to our program, and he knew English, but there was, and I think he would tell you this, there was some insecurities to know that, hey, I'm going to be sitting in a classroom full of other students where all the professors are going to be speaking nothing but English. And to watch his growth as a student, to do what he did, really, truly is remarkable. And, you know, as a person, it's hard to find a better person than Emilian. I mean, this is a guy who is an unbelievable teammate. He loves not only Kentucky, but he loves his team. He loves his teammates. He is a guy who is brutally honest. And as a coach, I could ask him about any player or anything going on in a program, and he's going to give me what he feels like. He's not going to give me just the answer that I want to hear. And then as a player, I've told everybody, and I've told all the scouts and everybody that asked me about him, he's as good as players I've ever coached. And I've been doing this over 20 years, and I've coached 26 guys to make it to major leagues, including Major League All-Stars. And this guy's as good as players I've ever coached.
That's quite the compliment there. We obviously have heard a lot about, you know, the prowess, right, at the plate, high contact rate, obviously a speedy guy as well. Is there anything perhaps in his game that you believe flies under the radar, or is there something that you kind of learned from him, from coaching him, you know, beyond the recruitment process and all of that, that you feel like, you know, it's something to keep an eye on as he progresses through the minor league system as well?
Well, I'm super excited that the Rays valued and saw him the way they saw him, because, you know, and what I explained to everybody that I talked to, especially on the pro side during the evaluation process, is this is a player that can literally impact the game on every single level. And that's really hard to do. And so obviously the Rays thought so highly of him, you know, he ends up being a second rounder, but I want you to think about this. The time they say play ball, when the Rays are at home in St. Pete, he's going to be standing somewhere in that infield. And at any point in time, somebody can get him a ball and he's going to make the most unbelievable web jam game saving play you've ever seen. He can do that. Oh, and by the way, he possesses enough arm strength to play all infield positions. Okay, then you say, all right, they got the three outs, and you run off into the field, and you go into the dugout now. Okay, he's going to step up to the plate. He's going to do literally whatever the game demands. He has the capability of doing that. He has great strike zone discipline, so if he needs to, he can draw a walk. Oh, by the way, he can hit the ball out of the ballpark. By the way, he can use the entire field. And now not only does he do that, then you say, okay, he just got on first base, and a guy hits a double. Oh, he's plenty fast enough. He's scoring from first base. Oh, at first base, the pitcher's really slow to play. No problem. I'm just going to steal second, and he's going to be able to do that. I mean, there's not a part of the game where he can't impact. And so I think you can see, and you can just hear the joy in my voice. Yeah. I mean, this guy is special. He's special.
The sheer excitement, and obviously the Rays organization should feel pretty excited about a guy like Petrie too. You know, growing up in the outskirts of Montreal, not necessarily a super baseball-centric culture. And Petrie himself has described himself sort of as an outlier, right? In the land of hockey, he comes in and he is that passionate about baseball, obviously playing other sports growing up and all of that. But how impressive is it that you have this guy that has this type of determination and mentality and really a feel for the game in that grew up, you know, you mentioned even the language, right? That was in itself maybe a learning curve. How impressive is it that he has had this type of success at the collegiate level, strong enough to be drafted in the second round here?
You know, another thing that I've shared about his story is I'll never forget Dan Rozelle, who's our current pitching coach, saw him in an event, and he told us about him. And I said, all right, tell me about him, whatever. He's like, well, coach, the first thing you got to know is, and I'm not going to hide this, he's about 130 pounds. And I'm like, damn. He's like, coach, just trust me. I watch this guy play. I watch him play shortstop. I saw all the plays. I saw this, everything he can do. I watched the swing. He's like, coach, you got to see this guy. And I'm like, all right. You know, I'm like, I'm going to go watch a guy that weighs 130 pounds, but let me go see it. And sure enough, me and the other coaches, we go out and watch him. And it's like, you couldn't help but just realize that, all right, this guy has a chance to be special. So just knowing that story about him, to your point about maybe him being an outlier. At the time, he weighed 130 pounds. He weighs 190 pounds now. This is a guy that from the time we committed him, he actually put on 60 pounds of good weight. And he's just committed himself. So by the time he got here, I think he might have weighed 160, maybe. He might have weighed 160 pounds by the time he got to us and put on another 30 pounds and got faster and got bigger and got stronger. And he just kept getting better. So, like, when you just know the whole story of him and you do your homework about from where he grew up, the baseball, I mean, during COVID, he had really no place to really work out and lift. He had to move away to go somewhere else to get all his work in. And when you start connecting all the dots and all the pieces, you truly realize quickly that you go, we got a special guy on our hands. And that's what he's done. He's proven that he's special in every way.
We're chatting with Nick Mingione, head coach of the Kentucky Wildcats, here on Jays Talk Plus. Show and Julia here with you until 12 p.m. Eastern. So Nick, you talked a little bit about your process and how you prepare these young men. You know, there's another guy who was taken with the 31st overall pick in the draft, Ryan Waldschmidt, outfielder. Now the third Kentucky first-round draft pick of the Nick Mingione era. I am curious, like, when you talk about guys like Ryan, you talk about guys like Emiliano, you talk about a lot of the young men who have played under you. You spoke about how you prepared them when they're playing for you at Kentucky. What are the words of advice you pass along to a lot of these young guys when they now try and, I mean, there's a lot of hard work that goes into playing in college. There's going to be a lot of hard work that awaits them, certainly, as they try and continue their journey in the major league. So what kind of advice do you share with them now that they're moving out of college and into the majors here?
Well, one thing is, the reason why I do want to say this, that I've had three first rounders is because of the players. They're just like, when you think of Evan White from 2017 and then Zach Thompson in 2019 and now Waldy, even guys like Pete, just amazing, not only people, but players. And but when they move on, the one thing I often tell them, and, you know, it's usually not until they're into professional baseball, because this time right now is exciting for them, but they just cannot forget who they are and the type of player they are. So, you know, what's worked for Emilian is obviously the skill set, his ability to do all the different things. That's still going to be the type of player he is, you know, and that's not to say that he would never tweak or make an adjustment to a swing, but you just can't forget what helped them get there. And in Emilian's case, it is a guy who's extremely focused. He takes great deal of the good kind of pride in his defense. He is always willing and able to do what he needs to do on the bases. So, like, for just to remind them that, like, hey, this is why you were picked. And then also not to feel like they need to go ahead and listen and start changing 5 million things, you know, and for them to work one-on-one with their coordinators just to make sure that they're all on the same page with their development and things like that. So it's a fun process, but they also have a lot to learn because minor league baseball is quite different than college baseball. So, and I think the biggest adjustment that they can make is just the ability to there's going to be a lot of different people that coach them, especially as they move. So making sure that they manage and deal with those relationships in a good way.
Nick, there seems to have been quite a bit of Canadian representation of late within Kentucky. A guy like Zach Pop on the Blue Jays or James Paxton are just a couple of examples of major leaguers that have been through Kentucky. How do you see maybe the growth of interest of talent in Canadian baseball? And does that add a little bit of a layer of focus perhaps on your recruitment process to see that there is more and more talent coming out of Canada?
Oh, and let me be the first one to say this. I love coaching and recruiting players from Canada. Make no mistake about it. Like, I've had the opportunity to coach some amazing ones. The first time I was here, I had the opportunity to coach James Paxton and to see what he's been able to do. And another one like Andrew Albers from North Battleford, Saskatchewan, had the opportunity to coach him my first time here. And then you mentioned it, Zach Pop. I've coached Jacob Robson from Windsor. He was literally just in our facility. I coached him at Mississippi State, and he was literally just here this past weekend. Got a chance to spend time with him and have Jacob take a picture with my son, who, when Reeves, my son, was first born, Robbie was still a player at Mississippi State, and I got a picture of him just hunched behind his little carriage. And now I got a picture with Reeves when he's nine with Jacob. So, coached obviously Tristan Pompey, and even a guy like Cole Cottam, who had dual citizenship, just has amazing, amazing players from Canada. And I've been super impressed over the years. They're still continue to put great talent. And even the travel ball coaches and the national coaches are just guys that just love baseball. And the thing I've learned about coaching players from Canada is they love baseball. The ones that have committed to it and they do it. And I really feel like the sky for them, talent-wise, is the sky's the limit because of the amount of baseball that they get to play when they get here full time. And it's been a joy, and it's been some of the most rewarding players I've ever had a chance to coach because, as I mentioned, the development piece, they get to come to a whole new country and learn sometimes a whole new language and sometimes a whole new level and different things about baseball. It's been really good, and I want to continue to have Canadian players in our program because how special they are. So make no mistake about it. It is a major piece to what we're doing at Kentucky.
Yeah, that's extremely moving to hear, and obviously it seems to be very rewarding for the coaching staff as well and what you're trying to build. I have one more for you, sort of in that vein, right, of watching just how much hard work goes into getting drafted, regardless of where you're from. But, you know, from your vantage point as head coach, does it ever get old to watch your guys, you know, have their names picked and go in and try to forge a pro career for themselves?
No, it doesn't get old. And, you know, there's times where I walk into our beautiful facility and I do all this and I'm like, man, Lord, you're amazing. I actually get paid to do this. Let that sink in. Like, what an unbelievable job. I get paid to be around an amazing staff that is super committed. And I get paid to help recruit and identify and develop people that love the game of baseball. Like, they love it. And I'm standing at one of our camps right now. We have a little over 200 youth at our camp right now. And most of these kids, their dreams and aspirations one day are to make it to the major leagues and to get drafted. And I get to be around a bunch of motivated people that some of them have had this dream since they could ever remember playing baseball at 5 years old. And this is all they've ever wanted to do. And I get to be around those people every day and help develop them and watch them like go chase this dream of, you know, playing professional baseball, but at the same time, falling in line with doing what I can to help our team play and win. And it is just so rewarding. So when we hear those names called, I had my son with me. We were watching the draft pick by pick the other day, and Ryan Nicholson got picked, and he was like, you know, and just to even see the joy on my son's face, like, because he knows how excited we are. I hope it never gets old. And if it does, I probably need to find a new profession. But still, the joy is incredible.
Well, Nick, the sounds like they are lucky to have you, and it sounds like you're in the right place. So we appreciate you carving out some time for us. Thank you so much for doing this, and when the season begins, best of luck.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There he goes, Nick Mingione, head coach of the Kentucky Wildcats. I don't think this is very common, Jules, but you can hear the sheer enthusiasm and love that Nick has for, certainly for baseball as a sport, but for these young men.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like we've done a lot of interviews with a variety of people, but man, that, like, it really comes through when he talks.
It truly does. And you hit the nail on the head when you said that he's in the right place.
Yeah.
Right? When you talk about developing young talent and keeping the love for baseball alive as these guys progress. And listen, there's going to be more pressure. There is going to be more challenges. You need to stay focused, especially while in college. You still need to stay focused on your education and on your personal development.
Sure,
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
And having a coach that can provide you with all of that, there's, you know, it's no coincidence that we're seeing success out of Kentucky in the MLB draft and beyond. It's really important to have someone at the helm who understands every moving piece of developing a college guy. So, yeah, pretty cool to hear from Coach and to sort of rekindle too, right? Even for ourselves here, that beginner's mind of baseball and the love of the game and things of the sort. So this is what the draft is. A lot of the time it's the opportunity, the excitement for something new, the excitement for what is to come. And I think that really translates when you have a head coach at the university level or the college level that understands that.
I will say one thing that Nick said that I kind of hated was that he basically extolled all of the virtues of Emiliano Petre, which makes me feel like, man, I kind of hate that he plays for the Rays. I kind of wish he goes to play for any other team. Yeah, the way he described Emiliano Petre, it makes him sound like the prototypical Ray, does it mm-hmm. not? Like, of all the guys we've seen come up through the Rays, very good farm system over the last, I don't know, like 10 plus years, essentially, much longer, honestly, if we're being completely honest. But he just sounds like the guy that fits the mold of someone who comes up and is good at pretty much most things mm-hmm. immediately. So on one hand, I am excited. I always will be. I got to say, I'm hugely biased towards all the Canadian ball players in baseball because I'm Canadian. I want to see these guys succeed as much as humanly possible. But it kind of bums me out when they play for teams that, you know, try and torture the Blue Jays as much as humanly possible as also.
Yeah. Again, that's exactly it, right? Show is you hear anyone talk about Petre and you kind of realize that he's in the right organization right now because the power is lagging, but there's a possibility that he'll keep building on that. But then you look at the other tools. You look at the fact that he is a very strong defensive player. He has wheels, so he can generate some havoc a little bit at the bases. And the contact rate, which is obviously something that we know the Rays have valued quite a bit in the past, the ability to get on base and to control the strike zone. This is a guy that comes in, and he has a pretty good chance at immediately becoming a top prospect for them just because of where he is in his development and where he is in his career as well. This is obviously a college guy. He's a little bit older. He's a little bit farther down the line, and you could see him impact the major league team relatively soon, which again is pretty exciting. And the Blue Jays probably going to see quite a bit of Petre in the coming years.
Yeah, I always will cheer for them, but maybe maybe when they don't play the Blue Jays,
right.
maybe the other like 150 games or whatever.
When he's playing
whatever
at Rogers Center, just go 0-for-3 with a walk,
yeah,
or something
sure.
like that.
Yeah. And then when he goes back to the Trop, you know, hit a couple of bombs, like whatever you got to do, right? No, our congrats to Emiliano Petre, who was taken 58th overall by the Tampa Bay Rays, coming through the system created certainly by Nick Mingione with the Kentucky Wildcats. Before we go, real quick, Jules, the MLB draft is officially over. It's done. It was a relatively quick affair. It kind of felt like, maybe because after the first couple of rounds, the you know, rounds 3 through 20 don't get maybe as much pub. But we have talked a lot about the MLB draft in the last couple of days. The Blue Jays taken 11 pitchers over the course of 20 rounds. They clearly are going heavy on the arms here, Jules.
Yeah, it's funny to hear teams say that they don't draft for need, but then you look at, you know, the areas that are lacking in that minor league system, and especially in the top prospect side of things, it's the Blue Jays have seen their pitching depth kind of thin out, especially in recent months. So it would make sense that they would backfill there. Obviously, another college-heavy draft, which is something that the Blue Jays
not a lot of young arms.
There, and you know, it kind of makes sense when you look at the draft class and the fact that maybe the high school arms or the high school talent wasn't where it has been in recent years. We saw other executives and scouting directors say the same thing around the league. But the Blue Jays have prioritized college picks over the years, and they balance that out with one or two, you know, high upside picks. Carson Messina in the round number 12, I believe, is a pretty interesting case of that, a guy that has a commitment to university, but it's possible that the Blue Jays might get him to sign. So again, college heavy with some high upside picks. It's what we've seen from the Blue Jays before, and it's what we saw from them against this year.
We'll see if the farm system ranking gets a bump in the next couple of years when these prospects begin moving through the system. That's Julia Kreutz. I'm Sho Ali on the other side of Jays Talk Plus. Dan Shulman will join us. Catch up with him this All-Star break. We're back after this on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hour two of Jays Talk Plus, speck of dust, or the Sportsnet Radio Network.
No judgment here.
Julia Kreutz, that's Julia Kreutz. I'm Sho Ali. We're also on Sportsnet 360. Probably drink some more water. So my wife says, she's probably right. She's probably not listening, which is probably also for the best. Joining us here on Jays Talk Plus, Jules, is Dan Shulman, Blue Jays play-by-play voice for Sportsnet. Dan, how's it going?
Good. How are you guys doing?
We are doing great. Thank you for carving out some time for us. Actually, I should ask you, with the not only do you have the second half to look forward to here, Dan, but you also have the Olympics to look forward to. Like, what does prep look like for you these days?
Olympic prep is huge, actually. So 12 men's teams, 12 women's teams, and of the 24, we don't know how many we'll see. Like,
right.
The schedule kind of gets determined, you know, not quite day by day, but kind of sort of, depending on the results and which other games matter. So I spent this morning working on Japan and Belgium's women's teams. And then this afternoon, I'm going to watch the Canada-Belgium exhibition game that was played a couple of days ago. And I'm going to be bugging Julia for pronunciations next week when I see her down at the Rogers Center, because she's from Brazil, so she's going to help me with with the Brazilian names as she did before the World Cup. So, yeah, it's fun. Like, I like the prep. I don't mind it, but it is this is a big chunk. So I think the Blue Jays and Tigers, I'm going to hold off on that until Friday. I'm kind of in Olympic panic mode right now.
Dan, real quick, before we move to the Blue Jays, let's keep you in Olympic panic mode then. How many Olympics, how many will it be after Paris here for you?
This is three. So what I'm doing now, I actually did for Tokyo. But it's funny, like, even a lot of people that I know who are like big sports fans are like, oh, I didn't know that. And I don't know if that's because the Canadian men didn't qualify or because the games were at such weird times because it was in Tokyo and all that. But we did it remotely from the CBC studios on Front Street. But I did men's and women's basketball in 2021 because of COVID, right? So it pushed it back a year. So I did that for Tokyo. And then way, way, way back when, and I wouldn't expect anybody to remember this, I actually did hockey in Lillehammer, Norway in 1994 for CTV. Which was, an unbelievable experience. And it's one of those, boy, this is cool. I'm pretty young and I'm doing an Olympics. Like, boy, this is cool. The Blue Jays made the playoffs. This will happen every year. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those, I'll get to do this all the time. And life changed and ESPN happened, et cetera, et cetera. So, but this will be my third Olympics. And what I'm really excited about is, unlike 2021, because of COVID, we're going to be on site. And it's not so much that I've never been to France and looking to tour around. It's not really that. I just, you know, calling a game from courtside is different than calling a game off a monitor, obviously. And there's so much excitement around both the men's and the women's teams that I just can't wait to see what happens.
Well, before we turn the page to the Jays then, Dan, real quick, what were your takeaways from that Canada men's scrimmage against USA Basketball. It started off pretty good, and you know, USA Basketball, as they probably will in a lot of these games, won that ball game. But I'm curious, when you saw the Team Canada on the court in Vegas for the first time, I'm curious what you saw.
I was doing a Blue Jays game at the time, so I actually it's on my list, okay. But I actually haven't watched it. I know they lost 86-72. I've read the stories and seen the box scores, but I actually haven't gotten to. I'm prioritizing the teams I don't know as well right now, yeah. You know, because that's what panic mode is all about. So I'm going to watch it. I did record it, and I'm going to watch it. To me, the score didn't really matter. It was more about just seeing kind of the different rotations and lineups that Jordy Fernandez was going to use. You know, how would Jamal Murray and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander coexist? Would they play a smaller lineup a lot, which they did? What would the bench unit look like? Things like that. So obviously, big work in progress. And they've got games, today is what, Wednesday? I think they've got games Friday and Sunday. I'm trying to remember. Is it, one is against Puerto Rico. I know that, and I'm struggling to remember who the other one is against. But I'm going to be watching both of those. But listen, they're going to be very good. But so are a lot of other countries. Like Australia, as you may know, played a friendly with the U.S. a couple of days ago and only lost by 6. And then Australia went out and beat Serbia, who's phenomenal. Who, you know, they've got Jokic, right? And they finished second in the World Cup without Jokic. So, and Australia's in Canada's group. So it's going to be very challenging. You get Australia and you get Spain and you get Greece with Giannis, and that could be 3-0. That could be 0-3. This is how it goes. There are no weaklings in Canada's group. There are a couple countries in a couple of the other pools who I think if Canada were to play them, they would have, you know, pretty much, you can't guarantee anything, but it would pretty much look like an automatic win. But in Canada's group, that's not the case, but you get who you get. And I'm looking forward to watching Canada's next two games. Again, seeing how Jamal Murray looks, seeing how everybody fits in together, seeing how much of a role Andrew Nembhard has, that sort of thing. So, you know, they played incredibly well in the World Cup. You know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Dylan Brooks both played incredibly well in the World Cup. Hopefully they can do that again. And this is, I think, a bit of a deeper, better team. They've added a couple of guys in Trey Lyles and Andrew Nembhard, NBA guys, who should help them. But, you know, France added Wemby and Serbia added Jokic and et cetera, et cetera. So we'll see how it goes, but it's going to be exciting. Like from the opening tip of the first game, it's going to feel like a game 7, if you know what I mean. There's no chance to really, oops, we'll get them the next time when it comes to the Olympics.
Dan, I have to say, I feel for you big time, because baseball season is a full-time job and a half, right? And adding some more preparation to that for a tournament like the Olympics, and completely different pace, too, when it comes to a tournament like the Olympics rather than a baseball season. But something that an even more different pace was the All-Star game yesterday. We saw Vladimir Guerrero Jr. obviously went 0-for-2, had a pretty good defensive play at one point there. But I wanted to ask you about Vlad's season to date, his first half. Not the greatest start to the year, and it seems like we would see maybe a little bit of a repetition of last year when it comes to, you know, unmet expectations, a little bit of a disappointment, and then the hits start coming back later on in the season, and all of a sudden he's hitting home runs left, right, and center in June and July. How have you sort of assessed the progress of Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and you know, if you could maybe look ahead and project a little bit for this second half, what do you expect from Guerrero here?
I'm hoping he continues to do what he's done the last couple of months. I mean, as you said, at the beginning, he wasn't hitting much at all. Then he started hitting for a very high average, but it was all singles. And then the power came. And then he got hit by the Gerrit Cole pitch, and the power disappeared for a couple of weeks. And whether those two are related or not, I don't know. But also, and you guys may have seen it or heard us say it on the broadcast, and it happened last night, actually, at the All-Star game, the bat went flying out of his hands on a backswing. Like, I don't really remember that with Vladdy much until the last couple of weeks. But we did see power in Arizona in the last game. You know, he hit that monster home run to right center. So if it's bothering him, maybe it's a little bit of weakness, but not pain or discomfort, and it's not impacting his hitting. I would expect to see him have a very good second half. I mean, I think I'm going to assume he's still here, that he's not traded. I think there's a very, very, very low likelihood of him getting traded. And I'd love to see him have a second half like he had the last couple of months. And if he can wind up with 25 to 30 homers and hitting close to 300 and an OPS, you know, at least up in the mid 800s or something like that, I think that's kind of, you know, the floor for Vladdy because of how talented he is. And it's kind of unfair to him. There's so much pressure on him because people like me always say because of how talented he is, but it's kind of true. But, you know, the team's going to change a lot, obviously, in the next couple of weeks. And I hope they still have enough around him that they pitch to him and he can just go out and do his thing.
Along those same lines, Dan, when it comes to looking forward to the second half of the season, I'm curious, apart from Vladdy, if there are other storylines you're really trying to hone in on. I you know, for me, Spencer Horwitz is one of those guys. Can he keep it up? Yariel Rodriguez in that four or fifth spot, I suppose, depending on what happens with the starting rotation at the deadline, vis-a-vis Yusei Kikuchi. But when you hone in on specific guys even, are there guys who you are really looking forward to seeing what they have if perhaps more playing time opens up? Again, trade deadline dependent.
Right. Yeah, those are two of them. And I'm assuming they'll be sellers. And I'm assuming, if not all, that at least most of the guys on expiring contracts will be gone. And there are six prominent names. I'm sure you guys have named them many, many times. We all know who they are. I don't know if any, obviously, I don't know if any of the guys whose contracts are beyond this year would be traded. Like, is there a chance a contender makes them an offer for Chad Green? They can't refuse. Is Bo Bichette conceivably in play? But I also think, like Vladdy, that's a very, very, very low possibility at this deadline. But assuming, even if it's just the guys on expiring contracts, that includes Justin Turner and Kevin Kiermaier, and that does open up time. So, like you, Shel, I want to see Spencer Horwitz like as much as I can, and hopefully he gets in there against lefties. And I want to see him at second base. You know, is the second base play still what it's been, which is totally fine at this point. And hopefully because he's so new to the position, he'll get even better there if that's where his future is. And I want to see him against lefties. We saw him against Valdez. We saw him against Hader, and he did very well. So just want to see him get as many at-bats. Yariel Rodriguez, 100%. Want to see him more and more. And beyond that, it's just kind of all the other Buffalo guys. Obviously, we all wish we could see Aurelvis Martinez. This would have been a wonderful opportunity to see, is he ready and is he a building block for the future? Unfortunately, that's not going to happen this year. But whether it's Ernie Clement or Davis Schneider or Stuart Baroa, or if they bring other guys up, I mean, he's older, but when Nathan Lucas gets healthy, I'd love to see him come up in September and just even if nothing else, like get a month's worth of service time. I mean, this guy has been scratching and clawing for years to get to the major leagues. And I think he's a major league player. I don't know if he's a star, but I think he's, you know, at least the strong side of a platoon at the major league level. And I hope he gets healthy. I don't know if we're ever going to see this guy, but you guys may know about a guy that they have at Buffalo who they signed out of independent baseball, Gabriel Cancel, who in like 11 games has six homers and five doubles or some crazy thing like that. And like, I can't claim to be an expert on him, but I can read a box score. And if it keeps going, like maybe he comes up at some point if there's an opening. So, and I did mention Leo Jimenez. That's the one I missed. I'm intrigued by Leo Jimenez. And I think there's a chance, you know, assuming Bichette is healthy and once IKF comes back, they could send him back to Buffalo. Like if they just don't have the spot, but I'd like to see more of him. I mean, he looks like he plays a very solid shortstop, which was his reputation. And I've been impressed by kind of the maturity and poise of his at-bats. And I'm hoping there's still room for him on the team in the second half. Like one thing I'm thinking is if Turner gets traded, then maybe Horwitz isn't always the second baseman, that he and Vladdy can sometimes split first base and DH. And if second base opens up a little more, maybe there's a little bit of room for Jimenez. But again, if you've got IKF and Bo and Ernie Clement and Davis Schneider play some second base, it's a little bit crowded. But to me, the last 2 months, assuming they're sellers, is all about finding out what they have, like all about finding out what they have so they can figure out what they need in the offseason.
Dan, before we let you go, in the interest of maybe finding out what they have here, Yariel Rodriguez specifically, there's been a ton of focus on building up his pitch count. There's an IL stint in there, but we have seen also a lot of upside from him in a very unique trajectory up to this point to be with the Blue Jays. What have you made of his first little bit in Toronto?
Very intriguing, but also pretty inconsistent. Like the last one against a very good Arizona team, a good hitting Arizona team, wasn't great, but the two before that were fantastic. So I think with him, it's smoothing out some of the rough edges. He's got five pitches. It's about commanding the fastball and having your secondary pitches play off that. And it's about throwing strikes, trusting your stuff enough that you can get outs in the strike zone instead of falling behind guys. And, you know, walks kill you. And he's had some trouble with walks. I think that the IL stint, as much as it wasn't a great thing, is almost one of these blessings in disguise, because it kept his pitch count down to the point where I think they're comfortable letting him stay in the rotation the rest of the season. Even if it means, you know, 5 to 6 innings, 85 to 90 pitches, I think they're comfortable doing that. And that would be the best thing for him, because again, they need to see what they have. Let's assume Yusei Kikuchi is traded. And even if they keep the other three guys in Berríos, Bassett, and Gausman, that's it. Like, that's all they've got. There's no Manoa. There's no Tiedemann right now. Like, there's no depth in the starting pitching department in this franchise. And we saw them take a couple of college pitchers in the first two rounds of the draft. And those, like, it's not the craziest thing in the world that those guys could contribute at some point next year. But I don't think it's realistic at all to think that they would be breaking camp with them or anything like that. So, you know, Paul Skeens didn't even break camp, and he's a unicorn. So I think they need to explore Julia Yariel as a starting pitcher because of the lack of depth they have in the organization there. And if that doesn't work, you can always say, hey, he's got a chance to really help in the bullpen. But first things first, let's hopefully get him 5-6 innings every 5 or 6 days the rest of the season and see what he looks like.
Dan, look, really good of you to do this. Take some time out of your Olympic panic mode for us. We really appreciate it. Hopefully you can get some downtime at some point. You can watch that Canada-USA game. Who knows? Maybe even get some Packers training camp stuff in there. Sure it's going to be a packed summer for you, but we appreciate it.
It's a fun summer, but a packed summer. I appreciate it, guys. I don't want it to sound like I can't be more excited about this. It's just the All-Star Week came at a great time because I hate panicking during games. You know, it's much better to panic during the All-Star break. So it's all good. I can't wait, and it's going to be an exciting couple of weeks for Canada.
There he goes. Dan Shulman, Blue Jays play-by-play voice for Sportsnet. He is the man. He is going to be awesome calling games for Canada USA, and we're still going to get him on Blue Jays baseball for as much as we can, which is always a treat for everyone here.
I cannot relate with him saying that he doesn't like to panic during games. Like, that is my one mode throughout 162 games of the regular season in baseball. Right now, I'm panicking right now.
You're panicking right now. It's true. Well, but there are no games going on right now. You can panic a little less.
Maybe. I guess so. It does make it a little bit easier to panic when there's no game going on.
No, I think Dan's going to do a phenomenal job, as he always does. But, you know, he brings up a good point when it comes to trying to forecast what this team, the Blue Jays, will look like, Jules, when it comes to post-trade deadline coverage. Because I was thinking about this the other day. You know, I was doing Jays Talk with Jesse Rubinoff, for example, on the last Jays Talk Classic, as I like to call it, before the All-Star break began on Sunday. And, you know, we were chatting about, you know, what are the storylines we're going to talk about post-trade deadline? Like, let's just assume, kind of like Dan says, that everyone that who's a UFA, everyone who's not going to be under contract post-2024 is traded, just for the sake of this conversation. So no more Kikuchi, no more Jimmy Garcia, no more Danny Jansen, Justin Turner, Kevin Kiermaier, Trevor Richards. So they're all gone, right? So they've all been traded for whatever they get back, prospects, whatever. So you go forward, like, what are the storylines to really discuss? So Spencer Horwitz, you laid out Yariel Rodriguez. But if Kikuchi is traded and all goes as well as humanly possible for Y-Rod, I find the idea of the starting rotation, which has been a strength of the past, what, like 2.5 seasons, essentially? Yeah. And I know they've taken a little bit of a step back, but still a pretty good strength for this team. What does that look like, right? I mean, who's this team's fifth starter if Y-Rod stays in rotation and Kikuchi is traded? Like, is it Bowden Francis? Are they cobbling together a fifth day out of a bullpen that has been, I would say, relatively beleaguered, to put it lightly, for most of the season? It's been pretty injured. Like, Jordan Romano probably not going to pitch again this season if they don't want to rush him back. So, like, there are a lot of question marks when it comes to even the strengths of this team moving forward.
Yeah, it is going to be fascinating. I believe it was Ben Shulman earlier in the week that made a point with us to say that if the Blue Jays do end up trading a guy like Yusei Kikuchi, they're probably going to need some sort of return package that involves
like a major league
either
arm.
A starting pitcher or someone that can eat innings for them, because you look at the depth, it's not there, and you're not going to throw a prospect in a bad situation, because the focus should be to keep developing these guys. And so when you look at a trade for Yusei Kikuchi, it is probably going to have to involve a major league ready guy that can pitch a ton of innings for them in the second half. So how feasible does that end up being when it comes to a trade like that, and with the Blue Jays really in need of another arm coming back? I don't know. And will that impact the market for Yusei Kikuchi? Will that, you know, tie the Blue Jays' hands behind their back a little bit when it comes to trying to make a deal like that? That is going to be something that we're going to follow. I believe that, you know, there's still a chance, obviously, that someone comes along and it kind of comes out of nowhere. Stranger things have happened. But looking at the farm system, a guy like Adam Macko was gaining a lot of traction, right?
Sure, yeah.
Before he got a little bit banged up and injured there. But there was some clamoring online, like, just bring him up from AA. Who cares? Let's see what he's got. And that's not going to happen anymore. Ricky Tiedemann is definitely not going to come up this year, even though it was something that we were all looking forward to certainly during camp. So there's more to it than simply making a trade or making the best possible trade. And it will be unfortunate to see if that does end up impacting the market for Kikuchi, because like you said, Joe, it was such a strength, and there was such depth to this group within the organization, and it just kind of evaporated very, very quickly early on in 2024.
I've read very often in the lead up to the trade deadline, we're less than 2 weeks from the deadline, which just seems like bananas to me that like we're actually here this part of the season already. But a lot of people are saying when they're ranking their available, look, and I use air quotes here, right? Available pitchers at the deadline. Because in theory, and I say this all the time, but if Juan Soto could be traded, like I would say literally, not once but twice, by the way, literally any player in baseball can be traded. But of all of the pitchers who are in theory actually available that are being shopped by teams at the deadline, if we're going to think that all-star Garrett Crochet is the number one guy at the deadline, and then the next available arms are guys like, I don't know if Zach Eflin's going to be available because the Rays are always kind of hanging around. They're like right there. So I don't know if they're going to be sellers really at the deadline. They might not want to. So let's say Zach Eflin even is off the table. Jack Flaherty is a name you hear pretty often out of Detroit. Blue Jays are going to see the Tigers starting Friday. But, you know, if you're talking about the best available pitchers, like I might honestly, even including Flaherty in this conversation, I think I would put Kikuchi second in maybe the entirety of baseball in terms of the most attractive pitcher available to other teams that need rotation pieces ahead of the deadline. I'd probably go Crochet because he's a little bit younger and he's under control for a longer period of time, but I go Crochet and then Kikuchi, who obviously is a UFA after this season. But I mean, look at the Dodgers, for example. We were talking about them earlier. You can make an entire starting rotation out of the guys who are on their IL, which is really unfortunate for them. But I mean, they need starting rotation pieces. There are a lot of teams that really do. You already saw the Brewers acquire, who was it, Aaron Civale from the Rays right before the break. So, like, there are needs for starters, and Kikuchi would fill that for any number of teams, as sad as it would be to see him leave Toronto. But, I mean, if Aroldis Chapman last year can fetch the Royals Cole Reagans and a minor league piece, and now you can say what you want about that trade for the Texas Rangers, because, I mean, they won the World Series, so I don't know how much do they care, I don't know. But if that's like a trade that fetches you someone like Cole Reagans, in theory, that's the kind of trade the Blue Jays should be looking to get back. Because Reagans wasn't great that last year, remember? Yeah. He kind of had some issues, and then he was injured, right? So like that's, I think, the ballpark of where the Blue Jays should be operating when it comes to trading like an established, talented veteran like Kikuchi.
Yeah, it will take a little bit of luck, too, in striking gold,
yeah.
Right? Cole Reagans was not a guarantee, but he has been extremely good. He is an all-star, obviously, and it started last year. He had a really, really good run last year with the Royals as well. So the Blue Jays have a chance to you know, hit the jackpot in one of these trades. But when you look at their unrestricted free agents, if they're going to trade any of those guys, or they're going to necessarily get a huge return package, something that really, you know, makes a difference when it comes to the buildup ahead, it would take all of the pieces falling exactly in the right place for that to happen.
I think so too. And don't get me wrong. Like, do I love fake trades? I love them. Yeah. Like, throw as many fake trades as you want me as possible. I'm like the first person on the trade machines online and seeing what works salary wise and prospects and so on. Even though I'm not a prospect expert, I love that kind of stuff. I do, but it is hard to really, to your point, to forecast what major league pieces can be brought back. Because I think the other part of it is, A, you can't trade draft picks in Major League Baseball as you can in pretty much every other sport, right? So that's a big part of it. But also, too, we just spent the last like 2.5 days talking about the Major League Baseball draft. I mean, you can be as excited as you want or down as you want on the Blue Jays draft record and this crop of rookies. But at the same time, like, the truth, Jules, is simply that it's so hard to forecast like what prospects are. It's just like when Luis Arraez was traded from Miami to San Diego earlier this season, I thought to myself, like, oh, is that a good return? Is that a bad return? Like, it's kind of hard to know right away, right? I just think those are the kinds of conversations we're going to be having as we get closer to the deadline. Having said that, if the Jays, at least for me, and I'm curious where you fall on this before we take a break, if the Jays, for me, don't sell, at the very least, the UFAs, it kind of just... Like, I know they've already said they're looking towards 2025 with an eye of retooling and an eye of competing in 2025. And okay, say what you want about that, but if they don't at least sell all these UFAs, I feel like it'll send some mixed messages to the fan bases, which is not what you want after a 44-52 start to the year, basically.
I agree. This is a time to lay out a very specific plan and one that has specific goals and follow through on it. It's we have seen maybe the Blue Jays, and especially when Ross Atkins speaks, there's an on-the-fence characteristic to what we have heard so far, and that is not going to fly in this deadline. So Whatever the strategy is, it must be well-defined and with clear goals in order to improve this team in 2025 and beyond. I have a question for you, okay, if we have time before we take a break. Because obviously this season, you know, you ask fans and they're probably going to say it's been a disappointment, it's been heartbreaking, it's not at all where we expected the Blue Jays to be. But looking ahead to the second half, show, what would you categorize maybe as a not disappointing season for the Blue Jays? What would you like to see happen, you know, whether sneaking out a wild card spot or even just, you know, trying to get the pieces to retool for 25? What do you think needs to happen so that you can look at this season and go, okay, I guess we've cut our losses here?
Good question. I think I would need to see Spencer Horwitz this is why I asked Dan about Spencer Horwitz, right? Because I want to know what he is mainly. And I say this because Davis Schneider got called up, which I'm just going to say this, it's still wild to me that Davis Schneider got called up for the first time in August of 2023. We haven't even gotten to a full year of Davis Schneider being a part of this Blue Jays story, which is just bananas to me. Time is a flat circle, honestly.
Seriously.
But I only bring that up because Davis Schneider had such a hot start to his career, and he's kind of struggled this year, right? Like, I'm not trying to really bag on the guy, but I mean, he has, since becoming a full-time player, still struggled with the high heat and the things we knew he struggled with. He's gotten a little bit better at them, but it hasn't been consistent enough, I think, to know definitively what he is as a major league player. Even if he is a major leaguer, not a minor leaguer, I think it's tough to know unless he kind of picks it up a little bit more, right? Spencer Horwitz has largely been very good. I'm just curious to see, like, if there is a point in the next 66 games where he struggles, and, you know, Major League Baseball adjusts to him to a certain extent, let's call it. Can he adjust back? And that's what I want to see, because I mean, he's hitting like .330 right now, essentially, in the majors. If that dips at all, and I mean, even if it dips a little bit, it'll still be great. But if that does dip at all, I just want to see what his bounce back is like. Because if he does bounce back, then I think I'll feel a lot better about labeling him as a part of the core, quote unquote, going forward, even if he's like a teensy bit older.
So for you, it's really all about getting these young guys to show a little bit more of what they have and figuring out what the core is moving forward.
Leo Jimenez, is he a part of that core? Is David Schneider part of the core? Is Addison Barger a major leaguer? Like, that's what I'm looking forward to. I want to see the Buffalo Brigade play as much as humanly possible. What about you?
Yeah, that works for me. I mean, I think a lot of it is going to fall on what the Blue Jays do at the deadline, and then we should have a clearer picture of what is going to be success or not for this team.
That is Julia Kreitz. I'm Sho Ali. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll bring in Brandon Weil, MLB writer for The Score. We'll ask him what he's looking forward to in the second half and maybe take a look around the rest of Major League Baseball, including the All-Star game, the All-Star break, about to wrap up here with the Blue Jays getting back in action on Friday. More Jays Talk Plus after this on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Final segment of Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network, also on Sportsnet 360. Show Ali, Julia Kreutz here with you until the top of the hour. Appreciate you all being alongside us. Joining us right now to help us continue discussing what to expect from the second half, maybe take a look back at the All-Star Game and the Home Run Derby as well, as Brandon Weil, MLB writer for The Score. Brandon, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
We're great. Thanks for joining us. Always nice to see you. Before we talk about the second half, I'm going to ask you the most important question I could possibly levy to you, Brandon. Yay or nay, MLB All-Star jerseys? Where do you fall on the All-Star jerseys?
I think it was a unanimous nay last night. I was actually surprised how many people hated the jerseys. I guess not surprised because they were bad, but I guess it was a reminder of how much people care about jerseys.
I only bring it up because here's the thing. I think you're right that on social media, it was pretty much universally negative. The person sitting to my left was someone who loves the jerseys. Julia loves them. She actually likes them.
Okay. I wouldn't go with love. Love is a very strong word, especially when you're talking about clothing items.
I feel comfortable in characterizing this as love.
I mean, I didn't mind them. I kind of thought they were fun. They had a little bit of a Texas flavor to them. You know what I mean? Sorry.
I think it wasn't so much the jerseys. I think it was that we were robbed of seeing all the players in their own jerseys. I think that was the worst part. I think the jerseys themselves were fine. If I saw someone wearing it or buying it, I wouldn't hold a grudge against them. But I think it's just so cool seeing all the different uniforms on the field at once, and that's what we were kind of robbed of.
Okay, so you wouldn't stop and like point and laugh, but okay, all right, that's fair. I think that's valid. Look, Brandon, we appreciate you carving out some time for us. Thank you for doing this. One of the things Jules and I were talking about before we brought you on in the previous segment was about the what to look forward to in the second half of what has been a tough year, right? It's been a disappointing season. I think most would agree. 44-52 for the Blue Jays going into the All-Star break. And now here we are, game, I suppose, 97 going to happen on Friday. So when you look forward to what there is to be excited for, let's call it, about the second half, what are you most paying attention to?
I think there's lots. Obviously, the trade deadline is the biggest thing that I think everyone's worried about right now. The addition of the wild card and how jumbled up the National League is might steal a little thunder from the wild card. So I'm kind of hoping a couple of those fringe teams fall more out of it over the next week and a half and really spices up the deadline. From a Blue Jays perspective, as tough as the season has been, I think it's a silver lining that they are so far out of it. So there is a direction that they're going to take. They're obviously going to be sellers. And a lot of Blue Jays fans that I've talked to or even in the media or just casual fans that I think they've seen enough of this core or this roster. And I think having a bit of a shakeup, having some new blood, some new names come into the roster, come into the system is actually going to be kind of an exciting thing for the Blue Jays and something that their fans can hope for in August and September. See some new players in the field, get rid of some other players who maybe that haven't performed as well, and just kind of get some new blood in the system and kind of maybe rejuvenate this team and see where they're heading in the future.
Brandon, staying at the trade deadline, but maybe zooming out a little bit, this figures to be a pretty eventful deadline, especially when you look at the National League playoff picture right now. So many teams contending. It's shaping up like a pretty busy trade deadline. But what do you forecast, you know, on a league level for this event, and how do you expect maybe the playoff pool to look after all the trades are said and done here?
Well, for the trade, I think we're going to have to see a lot of aggressive buyers, especially in the American League and National League. Dave Dombrowski is always ultra aggressive. I don't know if you saw Bryce Harper speaking yesterday before the All-Star game, and he was raving about Dombrowski, and they're in the biggest World Series window that they could possibly be. So I expect them to be very aggressive Obviously, Dave Dombrowski is always aggressive, but I think right now that they realize they have a bad taste in their mouth after last year. They're going to be super aggressive. I think the Yankees, obviously, with their Soto window, we don't know if he's going to re-sign. I think they're going to be very aggressive. I think a team like the Mariners or in the Padres are going to be aggressive. We talk about Ross Atkins potentially being on the hot seat. Jerry DePoto and AJ Preller are very much on the hot seat. I think they have to deliver this year. So I think what's good is that we might not have a lot of sellers, but I think we're going to have some very aggressive top of the food chain buyers. So I think that's good if you're a selling team. You're going to see prices go up. Look what the Royals just paid for Hunter Harvey. They gave up their number two prospect and a first-round draft pick for a good, not great reliever. So not to go back to the Jays again, but when you see these types of prices being set early on, you have to kind of salivate a bit if you're Ross Atkins and you have a guy like Kikuchi who might be potentially a top three, top five arm available, or Danny Jansen. With Danny Jansen, you look at what the Red Sox got for Christian Vasquez a couple of years ago.
Right.
Vasquez was a rental. You get Willy Abreu, who's a really nice piece and a building block moving forward. He's their starting right fielder right now. And you get Emmanuel Valdez, who's like a plug-and-play second baseman, more of a quad A guy. But those are the types of things that you can kind of dream of if you're a seller right now, is that it's a seller's market. There's some very aggressive buyers, and we could probably get more than maybe we thought we would for a rental in previous years.
We're chatting with Brandon Weil, MLB writer for The Score. You know, you bring up a really interesting point, Brandon, about who has the ability, perhaps, to dictate this seller's market more than most, right? Because I think if you were to ask most people, even what, like a couple, maybe a month or two ago, the White Sox probably are going to be a big part of that. Because like, if they so chose, they could deal both Garrett Crochet and Luis Robert Jr. and get a whole haul back. And I mean, which of those teams you just named wouldn't be better off for having one, if not both of those guys? Like, I mean, I take it back. Every team in Major League Baseball would be better off for having both Garrett Crochet and Luis Robert Jr. And they don't, they being the White Sox, they don't have to trade Robert Jr. if they don't want to. Certainly seems pretty likely that they will trade Garrett Crochet, but I find that really interesting because the Jays are another one of those teams, Brandon, that if they really wanted to, they could effectively dictate how this trade deadline goes, because we're not only in theory talking about the UFAs, and I know a lot of insiders have said that essentially they have no intent to trade guys with term, but if they really wanted to, if you were open to trading a Chad Green, if you're open to trading a Chris Bassett and really dive further into a retool or a full-on teardown, I almost feel like there aren't a lot of teams out there like the Blue Jays that have that ability to trade a variety of guys, get a lot of prospects back, in theory still be competitive next year, but really change the balance of what awaits everyone in about 2 weeks or so.
No, I completely agree. And going back to guys with term, like Luis Robert, Jazz Chisholm, right, Brent Rooker, that also involves other teams like the Blue Jays. You can buy and sell. The Rays are notorious for this, but if the Blue Jays really want to retool next year, there's no reason why they couldn't go out and get a Robert or a Chisholm or a Rooker, guys with terms with 2-3 years left of control. So I think that opens up things too. It's not just necessarily the teams going for a World Series this year. When there's players with term, it opens up the market to other teams who think that maybe we're going to be good in 2025 or 2026. So I think that really helps. And to go back to the Blue Jays, I think I don't expect Bichette or Vlad to be traded in the next 2 weeks. I think that's way too much of an undertaking for the front office to do right now. But you definitely have to test what their market is right now. And those conversations might bleed into the winter. Maybe you talk about Bichette with the team right now. Maybe you don't line up necessarily, but you revisit those talks in the fall. But also, the Blue Jays are probably going to approach Bo and Vlad about an extension this year. So you'll get to see what teams are willing to offer and what you're willing to offer maybe financially. And then you can kind of gauge, is this a player that we have a vision with the future, or is this a player that we know that we can recoup major assets coming back and help build the team? Not that Bo or Vlad are on a Soto level, but look at how the Padres were able to rework their farm system and their major league roster with the return they got for Soto. They traded a generational player, but they still have a really good team. And you could argue they're a better overall team right now with the package they received from Soto. So there's a lot of different ways that you can navigate the deadline. It's not just selling when there's a lot of guys available that have some extra term.
Brandon, let's move on from the trade deadline for a little bit. And let me ask you about just the standings right now and where the American League East is. Obviously, these teams are probably going to look a little bit different at the very least after the deadline. But you have the Orioles at 58 and 38. You have the Yankees at 58 and 40. The Red Sox, a winning team right now at 53 and 42. Do you have maybe a favorite out of this division, especially obviously between Baltimore and New York here? From what you've seen so far, where do you think the chips are going to fall in the AL East when all is said and done here?
It's kind of funny that the Red Sox have really snuck in there.
Yeah.
I think they were over 10 games back at one point, but now they're 4.5. I don't think the Red Sox have the depth to really compete with those two teams. If I had to handicap and pick a favorite, it'd be the Orioles, just because I anticipate them being aggressive at the deadline. I think they have a lot more players on the verge of coming to the majors in their system that can maybe give them a spark over the next 2 months. The Yankees have really floundered recently, and I think they're not this bad, but I also think they weren't as good as they were playing earlier in the season. Their pitching has really taken a step back, which I think we all kind of anticipated. I think Gerrit Cole, once he gets a few more starts under his belt, will be better, but Carlos Rodon has really struggled. Nestor Cortez has struggled. Luis Gil has kind of hit that rookie wall. So I trust that they're both playoff teams, the Orioles and the Yankees, but I think the Orioles just have more depth, and I think they're better served for the long run.
You know, I do agree with that. I do wonder how willing, knowing that at least for now, it feels like the window for the Orioles is pretty wide open, but I do wonder how willing they would be to trade, even from what we all collectively view, I think, Brandon, as a position of strength when it comes to their stocked farm system, their prospects, and so on. I do wonder how willing they would be to actually give up a major prospect, even if it does mean getting back. I don't know if it means like getting Kikuchi or Crochet, but I mean, they're one of their bigger needs is starting pitching. And you know, if you can get a guy for just money going forward, only money, quote unquote, instead of trading away a valuable major league prospect, you know, you probably prefer to do that. Having said that, as we know with the Blue Jays, like sometimes the windows are not as open or for as long as you think, right? So I just find it interesting to see what the Orioles will do in terms of balancing those two ideas, right? Like being competitive right now with some guys who are really talented and Gunnar Henderson and Adley Rutschman and so on versus and maximizing the window you have with the Corbin Burns, but also trying to make sure that these waves of talent, so to speak, are going to keep coming from the minor leagues.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting balance. I think they probably know which pieces they see as long-term core pieces on the major league roster. And you can only play so many people in the major leagues. I mean, depth is great, but a big part of stockpiling these assets is because you want to trade for them. As far as money, they have the new ownership coming in, but they also have to worry about contracts for Gunnar Henderson eventually, Adley Rutschman. Corbin Burns is going to be a free agent this year. I do agree that I don't think they're in desperation mode. I don't think they're going to empty the farm system for a Crochet. Maybe a Tarek Skubal if he were available. I think he's more of a safer bet. But I also don't know if the Tigers would want to risk losing him with so much of control left.
Yeah.
I don't think the Orioles are so desperate. And the AL is so wide open. And like you said, you don't want to take a window for granted. But I do think that maybe they think that maybe with a couple minor pieces, they're good enough to win it all right now, and they don't need to totally empty the cupboards for a player maybe they're not completely sold on. But then again, this is why you stockpile pieces to trade them. I mean, they've already shown that they're going to be aggressive. They traded for Corbin Burns. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Obviously, we know their prospects are so highly rated. Their farm system is so highly rated. But it'd be interesting to see their internal, how they internally rate everyone. Would they be willing to move off from a Jackson Holliday? Probably not, but they're probably their second and third tier is so deep that they would probably have the pieces to make any trade that they'd want to. It's just a matter of if they want to give up those pieces right now.
Ben, I wanted to ask you about the Cleveland Guardians here. It is pretty unbelievable that they are right now the best team in the American League. You know, new manager coming in, Terry Francona retires, Stephen Vogt comes in. A team that obviously has a ton of young talent, but I don't think anyone expected them to be this good. What have you made of it, and is it sustainable? Is this for real for the Cleveland Guardians?
I think we talk about Rays magic a lot, but I think the Guardians have a bit of their own magic, and especially with Francona leaving, obviously one of the greatest managers ever. We thought there maybe there was would be a step back, but Stephen Vogt has done a great job. And you look at that team and no one aside Jose Ramirez and maybe Josh Naylor, no one really scares you. But
Stephen Kwan's pretty scary though. Stephen Kwan has been really scary of late.
Yes. He's great, but he doesn't like when he comes up to the plate, it's not Judge and Soto type thing, I guess. But even they've relied on starting pitching forever and their starting pitching hasn't been really that great. I don't necessarily know exactly how they're getting it done. They're a team that when they hit the playoffs, I don't know if I'd be totally scared to play them. I think if I had to pick a list of the current playoff teams now, if I were to pick my own opponent, I'd probably pick Cleveland. That's probably asking for pain. They'd probably sweep me if that was the case. But I'd say they're still the least threatening. I'm not trying to disrespect them, but they're probably the least threatening playoff team just because I don't love their offense and their pitching. But they do deserve major credit because what they've been able to do with this roster and with their payroll, it's really incredible.
Yeah, it really is. I got to say, I think I've said this before many times, Brandon, but I do enjoy cheering for Canadian baseball stories. And I think the Nailers make that very easy when it comes to the Guardians. I totally agree. Before we let you go, you mentioned the Yankees, and I think I agree that they are not as good as we saw to start the year, maybe not as bad as they have been playing most recently. But I do wonder, I mean, there was that recent road trip right before the All-Star break when we heard that not only Brian Cashman was traveling with the team, but like Hal Steinbrenner was traveling with the team. And I don't know if that necessarily like is a signpost to say they're in trouble necessarily, but it does make me wonder, you know, even when, and we've heard Steinbrenner say in the offseason and throughout this year that they're going to be cutting payroll. It does make me wonder like what the future of this team is. Cause they're kind of like in that middle ground, right? They're not super young, but they're not that old either. Like some guys are, but they do have some prospects coming up and they have young guys playing for them already, like a Ben Rice or an Anthony Volpe, for example. So like how do you forecast what the Yankees are? Because they're one of those teams that they're the Yankees. They're always going to be spending tons of money. They're always going to do what they want. But, I mean, that only goes so far, right?
No, I agree. And the Yankees are really tricky because you would think they would be better. Like, you are getting prime Aaron Judge. Like, Aaron Judge is arguably the best player in baseball. I mean, obviously, you can make an argument for Ohtani and some other guys. But Judge, his last month and a half, he's been incredible. And we talk about wasting primes of players like Mike Trout, like, the Yankees have not reached a World Series with Aaron Judge, and he's been absolutely incredible. Juan Soto is another generational player. They only have for another year. Gerrit Cole won a Cy Young last year. It's weird. I don't understand why these ingredients cannot produce a winner. It seems like there's always something lacking. This year they wanted more edge, so they got Alex Verdugo and Marcus Stroman. And you saw the last play to enter the break for Verdugo, misplays that ball going over his head. Yankee fans are starting to turn on him. So it's like, whatever, they always seem to go out and get what they need, but then what they have is never what they need. Like, it always seems like the equation always seems to be changing. So I don't know what the Yankees need to do. They always go and get, like I said, what they need. They needed an ace. They got Gerrit Cole. They needed a middle of the order left-handed power bat. They got Juan Soto. And who knows come playoff time what happens, but I'm sure if they miss the, or if they don't make the World Series, don't win the World Series, we'll all talk about how Aaron Boone and Brian Cashman are going to get fired. Neither of them will, and they'll run it back, and we'll be having this exact same conversation next July.
Like every year that is what we discuss.
That's true. Yeah, we'll pencil you in for this same conversation next year during the All-Star break, Brandon. Look, we appreciate this, man. Thanks for doing it. It's nice to see you. Nice to catch up with you, and I'm sure we'll both see you around the ballpark.
Awesome. Try to find something to watch through the next 2 days.
Yes, we will. You too. There he goes. Brandon Weil, MLB writer from The Score. Appreciate him joining us here on Jays Talk Plus. It's true. Like I said, to start the show, Jules, the quietest part of the sports calendar. Yes. But for us, it continues here on Jays Talk Plus. I think we're going to get Keegan Mathison tomorrow. So we'll complete the reunion for the Toronto MLB.com Bureau, I suppose.
The Canadian Bureau, call it. Yes. We have dubbed us ourselves the Canadian Bureau.
The two of you have dubbed yourselves this. Yes. Okay.
The entire Bureau is made up of the two of us. We basically call all the shots. It's great.
I like it. Well, you know what? We'll have to catch up with Keegan tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it. Before we go, you know, I want to do this tomorrow. Maybe we can get Keegan to do this with us tomorrow as well. I want to do first half of the season awards. And I know I know it's tough it's been a tough season, right? Like when the season is going well, it's really fun to do awards. When the season is not going well, it's a little tougher to be like, these are the bright spots, right? Because you don't want to be seen as like, you know, glossing over things that are not going well. But
I just don't want to get Twitter mentions about it. You know what I mean? I don't mind. I just don't tweet at me. Don't text. It's fine. This is fine. Just an exercise.
Here's what you tell me if we're leaving a category out, okay? Yeah. Biggest surprise, most improved player, best reliever, best starting pitcher, and MVP. Are we leaving anything out?
I think that's very good. Yeah, right. You know, that pretty much covers the entirety. Maybe a defensive player we could argue to, but that would just be Dalton Varsho. What's the point?
Honestly, it's true. If you're not picking Varsho or Kiermaier, like what are we? So you're okay with those being our five categories?
Sure
tomorrow?
Am.
Okay. I'm going to try and resist putting Vladdy in multiple categories because he has been pretty one of the few bright spots. But I think that's the fun of choosing a variety of players. I think I'm going to try and limit it to one guy in each category.
I have to say, we did it last year because I did this show during the All-Star break with Ben Shulman last year. It was a lot easier to do it last season than it was. You know, the Blue Jays had a winning record. Things were going relatively well. Obviously, there were some question marks, but... it wasn't a super tall task to find those bright spots. But, you know, it'll be a good exercise and keeping things light at the All-Star break.
I think so, too. Yeah, that'll be fun. So text in those first half of the season awards tomorrow, 590-590. We appreciate you guys being alongside us. Thanks to Nick Mingione, Dan Shulman, Brandon Weil. Thanks to Jen Rolnick, Amit Mann, Austin Mackey. For Julia Kreutz, I'm Sho Ali. We're back tomorrow with more Jays Talk Plus. Talk to you later.